Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. Joining me is an entrepreneur who's in the cryptocurrency space. It is a space that's been full of potential and opportunity, and I wonder if there's profits and real businesses being built there. Today's guest says, well, one of the ways that we can get more profits, more people involved in it, is if it was easier to account for the cryptocurrency that people have. And what he did is create what has been called the QuickBooks of cryptocurrency. His name is Alon Morak. He is the founder of Blocks. Blocks allows professionals to do crypto accounting, tracking, management. What is auditing, document, everything really, to keep track of your cryptocurrency. I invited him here to talk about how well the business is doing today. And you know, I wouldn't have him on if it wasn't doing well today, but also about the vision, how he got here and what the vision is for the future. This interview is sponsored by two phenomenal companies. The first, if you're looking to do blockchain or any other technology, and you need to hire the right developers, you should go to TopTal. And the second, if you're trying to promote anything, trying to explain anything, trying to do any kind of marketing automation, you got to check out ActiveCampaign. But I'll talk about those later. First, Alon, good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What is your revenue? Let's talk about that.
Our revenue is growing. I won't say any kind of specific numbers, but I could say that we started our enterprise offering we started at the beginning of this year, so 2019. We already have around 100 companies using the platform, and we are expecting to finish the year probably at around 130, 140. And so we're doing very well in terms of getting clients on board, and we're getting really, really big names from the industry, kind of the top tier companies from the industry, which is great.
Can we say over a million or under a million yet?
I'd rather not say.
You're not even going to say that. All right. I've got the number here in front of me, but I guess you told our producer in private, so I'm going to keep it to myself. It's doing well, and it's a subscription-based business, right? Yes, there's a free model, but ultimately, if anyone has anything substantial, they're going to switch up to the $100 a month minimum plan, and it goes all the way up from there. Why does anybody need this?
Well, as it turns out, that moving from or even managing crypto assets is very different than managing traditional assets, both in terms of the actual tools you have and just standardizing the data. In crypto, what is one of the kind of the key aspects of it is what we call fluidity of accounts. It's basically your ability to create wallets endlessly with zero cost, which really kind of creates an issue for anyone who wants to track those assets and manage them, because you can have hundreds of wallets on different blockchains, on different exchanges, and you have somehow need to consolidate all of the data, organize it. There's a lot of data types. Those types are getting more and more advanced all the time. New types are created, and so on and so forth.
Let me ask an ABC question, just really fundamental basics. Why do we need so many wallets when we're buying cryptocurrency?
So funny enough, you should ask. First of all, it's one of the properties of crypto or blockchains in general. Creating a wallet is very, very cheap. Second, you have blockchains like Bitcoin where the actual wallet underneath it has a ton of different addresses. This is the way most wallets work, specifically in Bitcoin and Bitcoin-like blockchains. And so you kind of out of the gate, you'll have a lot of addresses. Funny enough, you should ask, because a lot of the tax optimization or gain and loss optimizations that companies can do is actually separating their different assets in the moment they bought them. Kind of the way we see things going is that they will actually have more and more addresses just because they want to save on their tax and optimize it. Just because of the way you calculate gain and loss and eventually pay taxes on them, but also the way you can actually optimize from the technology level itself.
Wait, because I guess in the US, if I hold on to a cryptocurrency for a year, then it's taxed as it's capital gains. Is that what the difference is?
So yeah, I mean, so you have basically two levels here. One is, how do you calculate those gains and losses? Obviously, you pay tax on your gains, or if you have losses, then not. And also, then the rate of the tax depends on how long you're actually holding those assets. The thing is that most kind of common method of calculating taxes or gains and losses are FIFO, so first in, first out. The thing is that, you know, if it costs you zero to actually create different wallets, you can actually separate those assets into different wallets and then decide which asset you want to sell and when, thus kind of optimizing your gains and losses. And so the way we see it is that actually companies will want to have more addresses and more wallets just to optimize on the gain and loss. And just I will just make a note that the reason why everything is so those things are so important is because every transaction in crypto which exchanges an asset to or from it is taxable event. It's not like currency where you can buy something in a supermarket and there's no tax on the differences in when you got that currency and when you spent it. In crypto there is, and so it becomes a big thing.
Do you find that as Bitcoin price goes up and down, as Facebook decides they're going to launch a cryptocurrency and then people just become disillusioned, do you find that as prices of cryptocurrencies go up and down that your business fluctuates, or is your revenue disconnected from that at this point?
So one of the neat things we've noticed that because we launched our enterprise offering just the beginning of this year, it was, if you remember, the height of the recession in the crypto space. And so we did very well despite the recession, despite bad times in the market. But yeah, generally speaking, most blockchain businesses are very much influenced by the price and the market. You know, if there's price goes up, usually there are more companies trying out new things. They're willing to spend more, and so the cycle goes on and on. And so, generally speaking, yeah.
You told our producer, "I've been in the block space for a while. I looked at your LinkedIn profile. I don't see. Well, I guess I kind of do see it. Where did you get excited about cryptocurrency? When did you get into it?"
So I actually got into it in 2012, 2013, at the beginning, simply just kind of going into the, you know, reading everything I can about the technology, contributing some code to the different projects, like a bit of code to Bitcoin, to Ethereum. And then toward kind of the past 4 years, I actually did professionally blockchain, if you can say that, in terms of working in blockchain companies and working on public projects, like obviously like blocks.
You know, I guess when I was looking back to see what were you doing before, it looks like 2012 you were doing home automation, right? Casa Lingua.
Yeah, just after that was actually a project with my dad. So just after that, kind of making a long story short, I've studied economics in Rome, in Italy, from all places. And so I came back to Israel for, I think it was around 7 or 8 months to do that project with my dad. And then came back to Rome kind of to finish my studies. And then I got excited about blockchain. I started to work in a local startup, and we were in an accelerator, and there was a guy that never stopped talking about Bitcoin all the time, every time. At first we started, we just, you know, laughed, and because all of his conversation was always about Bitcoin, you know, but eventually kind of got through and I started looking it out and kind of fell in love.
What made you fall in love with it?
Well, actually, so before I actually started looking at the technology, what happened was I tried to move a bit of money from my Israeli bank account to my Italian bank account because I obviously lived in Italy. And that was, I don't remember, I think it was 2012, maybe beginning of 2012. And what happened was I went to the actual bank, right? It was 2012. I actually went physically to a bank. And started asking how much it will cost. And the teller there told me, look, there's a fixed cost and then a variable cost. We have no idea how many banks in the way the money will go through. So we don't know, I don't know how to tell you kind of the calculate you the final fee you're going to pay. And I was shocked. Like, you know, it's not like somebody comes to the bank actually with bags of money and flies to Rome, right? It's everything is digital and they couldn't tell me. And so that was kind of a point where I said, you know, I have no idea what Bitcoin is, but there's no way that we're so, you know, 2012, the teller can't even tell me how much money I'm going to pay moving money between, you know, two Western banks that have relations with one another. And so I started to dig in and fell in love with the technology, fell in love with how elegant of a solution it is. And kind of that got me started.
I noticed that just before you founded Blocks, you were working at a company called Payki. If I understand it right, you smiled as I said that. Tell me about Payki. What put a smile on your face as I said it?
No, nothing.
It was just that I was bringing back a company that you were part of. From what I saw, what Payki was doing was they were saying, hey, look, the one thing that is consistent throughout all the apps that we use to communicate with people is the keyboard. Like even on an iPhone, you can change the keyboard. And so what Payki decided to do was create a standard keyboard that you can type on your screen with, but it had a button to send money. So if I was in Skype, I could send money in Skype. But if I was in Facebook Messenger, I could do it in Facebook Messenger. Mm-hmm. And it was marketed towards banks to enable them to let their users send money, right?
Right. Actually, Payki started as in a different name called GetGems, and was a blockchain project at the beginning, at least.
I think when you were with it, was it blockchain?
Yeah, I think they changed. I think the company was founded in 2014, and I think they changed to Payki maybe beginning of 2016. I'm not entirely sure about the dates, but I worked like about a year before at GetGems, which was it's Payki just in a different name. And we worked on a blockchain project.
What was the blockchain project there?
So it was actually very similar. It was taking the Telegram source code. Telegram, I don't know if now it's still an open source. Yeah. So it was, or maybe still an open source project. So we basically took the Telegram code for iOS and Android, gave it a different colors, and added functionality to actually have a wallet, Bitcoin, I think just a Bitcoin wallet, maybe also Ethereum wallet, I'm not sure. Built into as a kind of a native experience, and so you could basically send Bitcoin to your friends using the Telegram chat.
Got it. All right, and then you went to a hackathon, and you won. What did you win with? That changed everything. That's what got you started with Blocks.
Exactly. So I think So what happened was I had that idea of I knew there was a problem for people to track their assets because I had. Bitcoin and a bit of Ethereum back then. And I knew it's an issue. I knew that it was just a pain. So I thought, maybe we can do something automated because at the end of the day, the data is there. You just need to wrap it up in a beautiful user experience. And so what we did was we set out to create a prototype for a hackathon. Back then, the hackathon had a pretty big prize. I think it was $50,000 paid in Ether. And so I said, there's no way to better kind of test your idea to actually build something and let people vote on it. And so that's what we did, and we won. And that was basically the first step in creating Blocks.
And so then you quit your job to go pursue it.
Yeah. I don't remember if it was before the hackathon or after, but during that time.
The thing that I'm wondering is the first version of the site wasn't even about keeping track of different wallets, right? So what did you build in the hackathon that won?
No. So the version or the prototype for the hackathon was a really, really, really kind of simple user experience for taking your Ethereum address and I think it was maybe a Poloniex exchange account, integrating them into the platform and showing all of the assets and transactions in it. That was basically it. It didn't really work well because obviously it was a prototype. It didn't look great. But that was kind of the core functionality for the hackathon. That's what we built.
And then the first version of your product did what?
So the first version, so after the hackathon, we took what we've built in the hackathon and worked a lot to basically change everything, right? And rebuilt it. I'll say the beta version was a web only version. And then once we got that working, we decided that we need to kind of move to mobile because otherwise people, it's going to be hard for them to use it. And so basically the first version, the first real version, public version included iOS, Android and a web app that all talked with one another. So it's a kind of single sign on. You can see all of your transactions everywhere. So that was the first version.
And see all your transactions. I'm looking at the first version of the website. It was called Coindash.io, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or Coindash is the name of the company. The website is Coindash.io. It seems like what it's allowing me to do is track my portfolio so that I can make better investments and then also follow top investors so that I can get guidance. on how to trade better, right?
Yeah. So what we thought was, we thought, okay, so we can solve the issue of actually tracking the assets, but then all of a sudden you have a ton of users, or hopefully a ton of users, who have a lot of data aggregated in the system. And so what we thought was, we can create statistics and analytics and tools so you can see movements in the market. So for example, you know, a shift between people holding 90% of their assets in Bitcoin towards maybe holding 80%, right? It's a big shift. And so creating those indicators, creating those statistical analysis tools, so to help people understand better what's happening. And we actually did that. We built that both in the mobile and the web. But we learned two things along the way. First of all, in a very, very volatile market like crypto, those indicators don't have the impact we thought they would. So they don't really create value in terms of new insights for the user. And the second thing was, we learned that we should have really focused just on the tracking, or mostly on the tracking, because there were two other companies who basically did similar things, and they had great success because they focused only solely on the tracking aspect.
Just solely on tracking what people's individual portfolios were doing?
Exactly.
Okay, so there were already two people doing that. Why not the other part where you get to see what professionals are trading? Why wasn't that valuable?
So there's a lot of things around it. So first of all, regulation kicked in. But other than that, we didn't see even that the kind of the simpler indicators and insights really worked. And so building something even more advanced when the kind of the basic stuff that doesn't even make sense, you know, just seems wrong. We were on the path to build it. We just saw that the inefficiency of actually having those insights, it wouldn't really agree.
Got it. It wasn't really useful.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. So there's somebody doing the one part of your, two people doing the one part of your business really well because they're focused on it. And then the other part of your business is actually not nearly as useful as you thought it would be. And you didn't see it becoming valuable anytime soon. And so you decided to pivot. What was the pivot towards?
I don't think we actually pivoted too much. I think that from the beginning, tracking was the big thing, because even if you want to create insights on top of the data, you still need the tracking to have the tracking really well. And so I don't think we kind of shifted towards a place where we didn't feel comfortable before. We just really focused the offering. So it took everything we did and really narrowed it down to the things that really worked well. I think
it went from being a social network to being a personal software, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you could look at it. I don't think it was ever a full blown social network. It was a tracking app with a ton of social features on top of it. That's definitely the case. But it wasn't, I think, the kind of social network as we think of social network. It was definitely something we want to do, but we just don't saw the value. There is actually, I think, a company which does that exactly. So it's kind of a full blown social network where you can integrate your wallets. I don't know how well they're succeeding, but we kind of decided, I think towards the end of 2018 to really just focus on, the tracking aspects, because we saw there's a big demand there.
Got it. All right. Let me talk about my first sponsor, and then we're going to go back into the story. You're now in San Francisco, even though the company's based in Tel Aviv, right?
Exactly.
So I don't know if you noticed it, but on Market Street, there was an ad for Tatango. And I remember seeing this guy who founded Tatango, Derek Johnson. It's like this guy was hustling, working hard. He came on and did a course for us at Mixergy. And at one point when things were starting to really grow with this company, and what they do is they do text-based marketing software. When things were starting to grow, he needed to hire more developers. And so Derek decided to go online and use all the sites that made sense. And then he started getting a bunch of applicants, and he had to go through the applicants. And then that freaking took forever. And the quality is not necessarily good. How do you figure out who's good, who's not? How do you go through it fast enough that it makes sense? He finally said, you know, this guy, Andrew, has been talking about a company called TopTal forever. why don't I just go try them? So he went to toptal.com/Mixergy. He hit that big button. He was scheduled for a call with a matcher. And along the way it works at TopTal is you get on a call with a human being at TopTal who understands the quirky way your company works, what you're trying to do, what technology it uses. And then they go and find someone who's done that for another company in a different application. And so they did that for him. And instead of giving him dozens of resumes, dozens of applicants, which always feels impressive, they just, from what I remember, gave him two. And so his CTO talked to both people. His CTO said, look, we could hire either one of them. We have to make a decision. Let's pick one. They picked one and they went with that person. And a little while later, the CTO said, you know, Derek, this guy is actually so good. He could be the CTO. He could take over my job. He's that good. And that's a level of quality that you get from TopTal. People who've done it before, who fit in with your culture, who are so good that they will blow your mind. We're not talking about the cheap developers. We're talking about the mind-blowingly good developers who love to work on big problems. So Derek and Tatango kept hiring from them and the company kept growing. If you alone need to hire developers, if you, the person who's listening to me, need to hire developers, if you know someone who does, I really urge you to go send them not just to toptal.com, but to toptal.com/Mixergy. When you go there, you'll get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. If at the end of the period you're not 100% satisfied, you will not be billed. That's top is in top of your head, tal is in talent, toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. I do feel like we need like a jingle almost, toptal. Then people remember. How do you get your co-founder? We didn't even talk about him.
Well, my co-founder, I've known him for since I was, I think, in first grade or second grade. We grew up together in a kind of a small place. We went our separate ways around 22, 23. And he actually went to China for 10 years, studied there, got married there, had a child there. And so I don't remember when, but it just flew there and they said, well, you know, I'll try to convince him to join in. So I flew to, Shanghai, spent a week with him and lucky enough during that week, Ethereum skyrocketed. And so it kind of helped in convincing him. But yeah, I mean, we've known each other for, I guess, at least 15 years, probably, even more probably.
18. What were you like and what was he like? As you said, you grew up in a small place. Where was it?
Just a small place in Israel.
What's the city?
No, it's not even a city. It's like 5,000 people.
Oh, really? Okay.
Next to a city, yeah.
What were you two like growing up? What were you into?
We actually were really, really good friends. We are neighbors also. Our smaller brothers are friends as well. And so, yeah, I mean, we were just regular teenagers.
I heard you were into computers a lot growing up. Am I right about that? I was. What were you doing with computers growing up?
So, you know, just basic programming from as far as I can remember. I always liked it. I always kind of, had a sense to it. And so, yeah, I mean, I just developed simple games when I was 13 years old, 12 years old, I remember. And so, yeah, it was something that kind of I did all my life.
Do you remember one game that you're especially proud of looking back?
I wouldn't say I was proud of it. It's
what was it?
But I think it was, I don't know how it's called in English, but that thing where you have that kind of a line going on the screen and a ball that needs to hit stuff and you want to blow those things up.
I forget what that's called, but I know what you mean. Yeah. It's an old video game. Yeah.
Really old.
Breakout is what it was called.
Exactly.
So you did that.
So a poor version of that. Yeah.
Were you doing it with the idea that you would sell it one day?
No, not really. I didn't know anything about it. I only got into startups probably, you know, at the age of 21, 22.
Got it. Wow. I would have thought that you'd want to do something like this. All right. So no. Why him? Why did you find him? Why did you say, I've got to convince this guy to work with me?
We were talking about blockchain for, I guess, 2 years prior. And I don't know. It just felt right. It just felt like a good, a good co-founder to have. So yeah, we went for it.
Were there skills that he had that you needed?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, he was a great salesman, and he was in China for as ever I can remember, and China obviously is a big part of the industry. Mostly, I just looked for somebody who has, you know, different qualities than I have, and somebody I can trust, somebody I know that, you know, just feel comfortable with, and so yeah.
Hey, there's an old Bloomberg article that says that you guys had $7 million stolen.
Yeah.
When you were CoinDash. What happened?
So back in, we did an ICO back in 2017. Back then it was really, really chaotic. And, you know, people think backwards at, about, you know, just from experience, how to do things and so on. There was no guidelines. There was nothing. I mean, it was really, really avant-garde. And so what happened was, because ICOs became so big, they've also become great targets. And so we got targeted. As far as we know, it's an organization. It's not a single person in the way kind of the attack happened and so on. Both the police and private investigators told us. But we did manage to get back a lot of the money back, with pressure from the police, and private investigators. So, at least that was,
how do they pressure them to give back the money?
They didn't say, at least, the police officer didn't tell me, but, it happened in two separate, events. And every time I've talked with him about it and said, yeah, when we're doing things behind the background, I couldn't, you know, I can't elaborate, but, that's what we do. And so, you know, I was happy because I got, some of the, Ethereum back.
How much back?
I think it was, 70-75% of what's stolen. I'm not pegging it to the actual dollar value because it was really fluctuating at that time. But in terms of the amount of Ether, it was around 70-75% back.
Wow. So you guys had your initial coin offering. From what I read, you raised $7.53 million. And then at some point you said, stop sending us money because of this issue, right? You shut down the website and then
it all happened in literally minutes.
Wow.
I think it was around 5 minutes. But yeah, I mean, what happened was, when we realized we were attacked, we basically asked everyone to stop sending it, sending the ethers to the smart contract. I mean, that was really, really fast, like literally 5 minutes.
Wow. And it shut you down. Were you able to still keep the money after that?
Yeah. So we were, one of the side effects of being hacked was that your sense of, you know, I want to get things right is much greater than otherwise. And so we worked a lot to make sure that, first of all, everyone who bought the tokens is happy and compensated. Obviously, the people who sent the ether to the hacker got their assets as if they send it to CoinDash, to the company. And we worked really hard on the product. We worked really hard on communicating everything transparently. So every step of the way, you know, what we're thinking, what we're doing, and so on and so forth. And I think that it took us about 2 months, but I think that we gained trust back. And we managed just to tell kind of the community, look, I mean, you know, it happened, but we're looking forward and not backwards. We're trying to, you know, make things right. We still have a great product we want to develop. We still have a great community. You know, it's one of those kind of pivotal moments where it's kind of make or break. Luckily for us, it was make more than break.
How did you go through it? Let's talk personally. I don't want to pretend that everything was easy for you. What were you going through?
I actually have no recollection of anything that happened during those 3 months, believe it or not.
Really?
I have, well, that's for a psychologist to say, but
you just blacked it out because it was so difficult for you?
No, I didn't black it out. I do remember stuff, but I don't remember, you know, as vividly or as in details as you would have remembered, let's say, you know, 3 months off.
But you didn't feel like, did you feel anything that you remember? Like, my life is over, my reputation is over, company.
No. I mean, there was a lot of, obviously, not in terms of, you know, existential threat of my life, but, obviously, you know, everything we've done prior was at risk. You know, it could have very easily ended up what we're trying to build. And so there was a lot of pressure on making sure that we are doing things right now in order to make sure that we are here, you know, to continue building products and continue.
But no moment of self-doubt, no moment of fear.
Oh, of course.
Talk about that. I want to understand what that was like for you. What are you like?
But I guess self-doubt is something that entrepreneurs probably feel every day, every single day. I don't know what it was kind of a, you know, it was just a moment in time where everything was tuned up. You know, it's like a reflex. Everything was tuned up to do a certain thing. And a lot of those things happen just with the inertia of things. It's why I'm saying it's kind of a make it or break it moment, because if you get pressured and make the right decisions, then it's a make it a moment. But if
you kept saying that to yourself, even at the time, you think,
I now am telling it myself,
but in retrospect, you do feel like your body instinctively said, if you don't fight this alone, you are going to break. So there's no other choice. We got to.
Yeah, I think so.
That's what it was.
You need to be strong. First of all, for your team, right? I mean, it's not like just you getting the heat. Everyone who got involved in the project is feeling the heat. And so you need to be strong for your company, for the team, obviously for the community. And you just need to push forward. There's only one way to go from there. Or at least for me, it was.
Got it. All right. And then you guys hired a private forensic team, but then also Israel's counter cyber crimes unit stepped in to help you guys out.
Yeah. So the police, obviously, because we filed an official complaint and started all the official investigation. And a private forensics investigation was kind of in parallel, just to understand from an additional kind of party what happened, trying to go backwards and so on and so forth.
Wow. I would feel at the moment like this is the end of me until I could get my bearings and say, no, I've got to fight. There's nothing else I could do.
And look, I mean, we could have just as easily used it as an excuse to not do anything. You know, hacking was pretty prevalent back in 2017, just because of how things exploded in the industry. I think what it really did for us, at least, was to really calibrate us to put in focus the important things. Because and you need to keep in mind that 2017 was a crazy time in the crypto space. Everything, it was like everything is kind of an open bar, and you can do everything. And in a lot of cases, people did a lot of things and kind of failed just because of that. They didn't focus. They didn't build the right stuff. And so for us, it was because what happened. It just made us more focused. We didn't do anything that had direct implications on the product. And so for us, it was a very focusing moment.
Okay. And so from what I'm seeing here on Crunchbase, your funding for the whole business came from two places. One, you sold a convertible note to Coincilium Group. And then another was you did the initial coin offering.
Yeah. So it's not just Coincilium. We have other investors. So we basically did a seed round where we raised money.
How much?
I think it was just under $1 million. And so our biggest investors other than Coincilium is also eToro, for example, which is
eToro, one of your clients also.
One of our clients, one of our investors, our biggest investor in terms of shares. And so we did that seed round, also did the ICO, as we said. And basically from that time, I think it was 2 years ago, we are financing the operation from those two kind of sources.
Okay. So when you started to pivot, was the vision to be the QuickBooks of crypto, or is that just a description that I happened to read when I was looking you up?
Yeah, I think the more accurate kind of description we would say is that we would really put ourselves as a management platform for assets, because at the end of the day, it's not just accounting or reporting. At the end of the day, those professionals need a piece of software that does three things or several things really, really well. So tracking, reporting, their ability to go through audits, their ability to present data for their CPAs to calculate gains and losses, their ability to accurately export their data into QuickBooks or any other accounting software and so on. So they need kind of a multi-tool that connects them with different things that happen in the day-to-day operations.
Okay. Did you do any customer development calls before or during the switch? Were you calling up potential customers and understanding them?
Funny enough, no. But we did know that a lot of companies had that issue. First of all, we had that issue as a crypto company. But we knew that from, you know, just knowing other people from the industry, they had the same issue as well. We kind of threw ourselves, you know, in the water and just started. And it just kind of picked up from there.
And so you, when you knew the problem for yourself, how was it different from what you discovered after you launched?
I think that, first of all, there's a lot of edge cases. Every company is different. Every company has that specific thing they want and really, really doesn't work in anywhere else. And so you find yourself, you know, kind of straggling between how do I build a product that I can get as many clients as I want, but still getting it focused enough that not develop, you know, not becoming a software shop, right? Just customizing everything to the death. And so that comes kind of our battle and deciding exactly what we want to do. And so, for example, we track all of the requests, our clients give us. And so once a certain thing kind of hits a few clients, then we know it's something that might be interesting to go and put into development. And so that cycle really becomes, kind of a part of the feedback clients give us. A lot of our time is spent on fixing issues just because of the complexity of the blockchain space. There's so many edge cases. There's so many use cases. And you find
a lot of, because you're keeping track of people's money with different wallets, you're saying that the wallets change and their issues and you've got to pull the data out, and that's one of the big challenges for you.
Yeah, exactly. So just imagine on Ethereum, you probably have tens of thousands of assets, and every asset has its own kind of peculiarities and so on. And so it becomes, again, kind of a race towards making sure that, because at the end, you know, when people pay you for something, they're expecting to work flawlessly. And so kind of their requirements are high. And so we want to make sure that we are portrayed as a stable and enterprise grade product. And so for that, you need to put a lot of efforts in making sure that all of those, you know, things happen seamlessly for the user.
You know, it just occurred to me when I interviewed Charlie Lee, the founder of Litecoin, I started looking at his past, seeing these different bulletin board messages that he had up. And one of the ones that got a lot of attention was when he said, I created this spreadsheet to keep track of all of my cryptocurrency. Does anyone want a copy of it? And people just were saying, yes, yes. It was a huge hit.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel his pain. Definitely. I mean, it's something, it's crazy. I mean, we've stumbled across companies who are managing tens of millions and hundreds of millions on spreadsheets and, you know, and everything is done manually. The error percentage is so high and it's so susceptible for errors that, you know, when you're managing so much assets and so much money, if you have a 5% chance of a 5% error rate, that's a go to jail card. It's not like a pat on the back, you know, fix your things for next year. That's a real problem. And so, and that's kind of what I kind of referred to at the beginning of our conversation. We, you know, what we do, we consider it as a fundamental building block, because you cannot create a $5 trillion industry where everyone is tracking their assets on Excel sheets. You know, the regulator won't accept it. The compliance officers won't accept it. And so you have to have those things in place so to make it very efficient and very bulletproof for companies to manage those assets. Because at the end of the day, you know, if they're not reporting those assets correctly, if they don't report it, even, you know, outside, but even internally for their board of directors, for their C-level executives, if they don't know how to calculate their gains and losses correctly in order to pay their taxes and so on, those are very dangerous things. We need to get straight in order to have, you know, a $1 trillion industry.
And that's one of the things that you told me before we started, that you really want. You want to help encourage growth of cryptocurrency, and the only way it's going to grow is if people can keep track of their currency properly.
I think it's a fundamental requirement, definitely.
Okay, let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. I'm actually going through your site to see like what email software you use. Do you use an email software? I see that you guys are hosted by WP Engine. You're on WordPress. Do you?
I'll have to ask our marketing director.
I don't think you do. You've got to go tell them to do this. All right, I'm going to make a pitch for you. I see you use Vimeo. I'm going to make a pitch for you to use ActiveCampaign. If I'm wrong, to switch to ActiveCampaign. Here's why. So you guys appeal to lots of different groups of people, right? So if I scroll to the bottom of your site, I can see that you guys have the product is for businesses. It's also for accountants and bookkeepers. It's also for executives. It's also for crypto miners. These are four different groups of people. Yes, they need the same product. Yes, they have similar interests and needs, but they're four different groups of people. Now imagine if I'm on your site and what I do is I clicked on executives and then I click away and then I click on the four businesses and then I spend a lot of time reading the articles and reading the information about the stuff that you have for businesses. And then at some point, I sign up to the bottom of your site where it says ready to get started. At that point, you should know, without having me fill in a form saying I'm looking to do this for a business, you should know because of what I've clicked on, because of which videos I've seen on your site, Andrew wants to do this for his business. He apparently is not a miner. He apparently is not a looky-loo individual. We want to target him based on that. And you don't need to ask me. Just because of the pages I've been on your site, you can automatically tag me and automatically start sending me messages that speak to my needs so that I know Blocks is for me. Now, if I'm a miner, you wouldn't want to talk to me like I was running a business, like I was an executive. You'd want to talk to me like I was a miner. And the only way to do that is to watch what people are doing on your site, watch what they're clicking on, and even at times ask them, but don't wait for them to tell you before you start to tag them based on their interests and based on what they've done on your site. That is the active campaign difference. And alone with active campaign, even though you're not into what software marketing automation software you use, you'll still be able to use it. Like if you decided, hey, you know what? I got to figure this out for myself. It's going to be so straightforward. You'll actually use it so straightforward that people on your team will actually do all the stuff that I'm talking about. And if you decide, hey, you know what? We're not just old technology of email. We want to do SMS. We want to do these other messages, chatbots, etc. They will work with that too. I'm going to give you a deal. Do you like deals?
Yeah.
You do? Good. Here it is. If you go to activecampaign.com/Mixergy, or if your marketing person goes there, they will get to use this software, try it out, see if it's for you for free. And then if they decide to sign up, second month free. And of course, because we all need some help when we're moving things over, we want to make sure that we're actually using every feature. They're going to give you two free one-on-one sessions. And finally, if for some reason I missed it and you guys are with some other software and you want to migrate, they will migrate you for free. That's activecampaign.com/Mixergy. activecampaign.com/Mixergy. Oh, I do see the software. You do have software. This blows your software out of the water. They will migrate you for free from your software. Just put it side to side with this. You're going to see it's way, way better. I see what you guys are using. Okay. All right. Yeah, you guys are using Amazon Simple Email Service and GetResponse together. My sense is Amazon SCS is probably for the software and then GetResponse for when people are getting ready to get started with you. This is going to give you way more features, way more ways of being interactive with your people based on what they've done. All right. I got to shut up. Seriously, you'll thank me. They'll migrate you for free. Active campaign.
I'll connect the marketing director. I'm sure he'll love it.
Cool. Good. I guarantee they'll love it. Let's talk about how you're getting people in. So one of the things that I did with you was I was saying, like, where does he get his frickin' traffic? Is he now, because you guys reached out to us, I thought maybe you're like on some kind of get links campaign or something. I went to Ahrefs, our partner for research. I typed in blocks.io. You're hardly getting any articles. The only thing that I see being linked over to you is like articles about bad stuff happening in cryptocurrency. Then they link to you. What's going on here?
I don't remember. Maybe you've searched for CoinDesk, not Blocks. I don't know. But we have a bunch of articles. If you go to our website, there's...
On your site, but not other people writing about you and linking over. That's the part.
There's, sure. There's a bunch of... Yeah. There was a huge campaign now. We did a huge research and report on... with I think like 30 accountants from the US, the biggest firms doing accounting for crypto. Okay. And we featured all of them in one report, and then it really hit a lot of different publications, or from, you know, Forbes all the way to Accounting Today and so on and so forth. So yeah, there's a lot of things.
What was in that report?
So we basically tried to map all the different challenges that accountants or CFOs of crypto companies face. Obviously one of the biggest things is actually tracking those assets accurately and so on and so forth. And so what we really wanted to do is just get their take on, how they, you know, because they're the boots on the ground, how do they see that? What's their challenges and so on? And then we summed it up into various statistics to show you how many of them are facing that issue and so on.
Oh, I see what you did. You went out to them and you said, look, what are the problems that you're seeing your clients have with cryptocurrency? And then you put that into a report. Am I right?
Exactly. It's like, I think it's like a 30 or 40 page report, very details, different subjects and so on.
It
was really their kind of content or their responses. And then we just, you know, simply bundle it up together.
You're showing 5%, only 5% of US CPAs believe the clients are, there's a percentage that believe that clients are not disclosing all of their digital assets to the tax authorities, right? So these are CPAs saying our clients don't have enough of a handle on this, that they're not reporting this properly.
Yep.
Another one saying that they need that companies need better guidance on the legal and tax ramifications. So basically you went to them and you said, look, tell us all your problems. And you started to organize the problems in this report. And this is going to freak people out. And the only solution is to start paying attention to the cryptocurrency that they have. Am I right?
Exactly. We gave them stage to say exactly what's on their mind, because at the end of the day, crypto is our assets and the financial implications are there and everyone knows them. And so I think really that, you know, the CPAs, CFOs, the bookkeepers are a lot of the unsung heroes of the crypto space, because all of that is going through them, right, at the end of the day. And so we wanted to give them stage and give them the opportunity to speak about it.
And then the way that people were finding out about this, then they were signing up to your email list, and then they were hopefully joining and becoming your customers, right?
Of course, yeah.
What else were you doing to get customers?
So we have a very active sales team right here in the Bay Area, in San Francisco, actually, not too far from you guys. And because we are very well connected to the industry, we are on the phone all the time, calling up those companies. A lot of them are still using Excel sheets, so there's some education involved, you know, letting them know there's other opportunities there in terms of using, you know, good software to solve their issues. But we are seeing more and more of them are understanding that there are solutions out there, and so we want to make sure that we are the first phone call they get in order to try out the system. And then, you know, starting an onboarding process. We do have, you know, people, kind of inbound leads coming in. People are calling us and leaving us messages on the website saying, look, we're trying to, you know, we want to set up a demo account. Let's see how it works. We want to implement it in our day-to-day operations.
And so your process is, if somebody fills out that form saying that they want to start out, you have a salesperson call them up soon after that?
Within 24 hours, you'll get an email saying, let's set up a call, let's talk, and so on. We're trying to get, you know, the right customers. We're trying to explain them what they're getting, because again, it's a new product. They didn't use something like that before.
And then do you guys also do any outbound calls, it sounds like? Where you're finding people? What's that process?
Outbound, inbound. So again, we're very well connected to the industry. So what happens was, you know, you get a client and then all of a sudden that client refers you to five other clients, potential clients. And so you'll start to get kind of map out all of the different connections and you know, just trying to get a phone call with the company first. And then obviously the person in charge or the relevant person and so on.
I'm going through the sign-up process now just to get a sense of what it looks like. I don't see where you guys have asked me for my phone number here, but you definitely did. You got my email address. You've confirmed the email address.
Exactly.
And then how does the phone call come in? At what point?
So you'll probably, if you left your details, you'll probably get an email from one of our representative and, you know, saying, hey, you know, you left your message on the website. Do you want to schedule a phone call for a demo and so on?
Got it. And then what about, it seems like you're also going to events. Am I right about that?
Yeah, definitely. A good place to meet the clients and people you couldn't reach online is definitely events. So we go into the big events. Some of them we have, you know, booths and so on. In any of them, you can just come to us, get a demo, talk about the product and see how we can help you.
Got it. And then you guys are converting that way. What's the enterprise product?
So we have a free tier. It's the same product, but it has different features or limitations depending on the different tiers you have. And so The business, enterprise, and custom tiers are all the non-free tiers. You can start from basically $100 a month. One of the first things we did was really cut down costs or prices against our competitors, because we felt it's a good way to, you know, break the ice and get into the company, or start onboarding the clients. And so you can start literally from $100 a month, and then depends on the use cases and how much you use it. The monthly price goes up.
I'm still looking to see what else is sent, where else you guys are getting traffic. I still see that the most powerful article, most powerful links to you are more about problem areas with crypto. And I guess now you guys are starting to turn the corner on that.
Yeah, definitely.
And then direct, I'm looking now at SimilarWeb to get a sense of where traffic is. Yeah, I guess it's SEO is not big for you guys yet. Right.
No, we actually started to work on SEO, but yeah, I mean, currently the search or search depth in terms of those solutions are still small, and so most of it is still door to door.
All right. What's the future for you? What are you looking to do?
We really want to hit 1,000 companies, 1,000 clients by the end of 2020. I think that will set us up really good in terms of market share, in terms of you know, just the amount of clients we have. You know, we are getting real engagement and real.
Oh no, I think we just lost. Oh, there we go. Saying real engagement. When you were saying you want to get 1,000 clients by the end of 2020, it reminded me about an article that I saw on newsbtc.com, where in there you said, we will be the platform to help manage more than 10% of the total crypto market by the end of this year. And that was last year. Did you hit that? Did you end up managing 10% of the total crypto market?
I don't think it was 10%, but we are managing, I think, around $5 billion through Blocks today.
And then what's the total market? 800?
No, I think it's 220 maybe.
220. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. All right. So you're doing well already. Why won't you tell us what the total revenue is yet?
I think it's pretty confidential, but we'll be happy to share it in future.
All right. The website for anyone who wants to go check out, it's blocks.io. They do have a free tier if you want to try out the software. I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first is the place to hire developers. It's called TopTal. And the second, I should say toptal.com/Mixergy, right? What kind of marketer am I? I'm not even giving them the actual URL. And then the second, if you want email marketing done right, especially if you guys are Blocks are looking to try it out, go to activecampaign.com/Mixergy. You'll be glad you did. Thanks. Thanks, Lone. Thanks, everyone.